Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello, folks. Just to say that I'm an idiot suffering terribly from the 1 hour of jet lag between here in Madrid and London. And I failed to plug my microphone in for the first 40, 45 minutes or so of recording of this podcast. Luckily, we are pros at things going wrong. So we were recording the Zoom audio, so you will hear me for the first 40 minutes, but the quality of my audio will be slightly diminished. But don't worry, I come back strong towards the end of the episode. Sorry about that, folks, and thank you as always for bearing with us. Enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, and a very warm welcome along to this latest edition of the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with On Location, the premium hospitality and experience provider. On Location provide packages via Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours to all of the four Grand Slam tournaments, including the US Open, which is on sale now with fantastic seats, hospitality and hotel packages available for next year's or for the year's final major event at Flushing Meadows in New York. Go to onlocationexp.com/TTP to see what they have to offer. My little stumble there revealed to the unsuspecting public that I am, in fact, reading that from a script. Hitherto, I hope that everybody thought that it was all off the top of my inspired head. David's here. Hello, David.
Yeah, hello. Just you reading out about the US Open makes me excited about the US Open, but first I've got to get excited about Wimbledon and Roland Garros first. So, oh, isn't it good tennis?
Control yourself, David. Matt's here. Hello, Matt.
Hello, yes. David's saying he's got to get excited about Roland Garros as though he hasn't been excited about it for the last 12 months.
Every time I go around Catherine's house, she gives me a different Roland Garros mug to drink out of.
It's the same mug every time, David. I've only got one. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, every time I look at it, I get excited.
It is a very classy mug, though. In terms of merch, Roland Garros has the others over a barrel, I think.
We should rank them one time.
Maybe it's not even Roland Garros. Maybe it's just sort of Paris, you know? Maybe they don't even have to try that hard to make it classy, but they sure do succeed. We'll be at Roland Garros in a few weeks' time. Of course, when do we fly? We fly 3 weeks on Wednesday.
Is it really?
I'm going to say that definitively because I know it to be true. We fly 3 weeks on Wednesday. I'm very specifically saying fly there because I'm still not over last year's Eurostar experience. That was a true horror that we won't be repeating, quite literally. So, looking forward to the flight, folks. You find David in his usual sunny Solihull, Matt in his usual sunny Richmond, and me in, I think it is sunny outside, but not in this hotel room, in Madrid. Scene of this week's and last week's tennis. I haven't been on site yet. I arrived today, but I will be going on site tomorrow, and I'll be presenting the coverage from the Mutua Madrid Open for Prime Video from Wednesday. And I'm excited because in terms of the tennis that I saw up close and personal last year that I was able to see live. Madrid is the best, I think.
Wow.
I mean, I got to see the only edition of Alcaraz Djokovic. I got to see Alcaraz Nadal. I got to see them back to back. I got to see Ons Jabeur in the best week of her career. And the position that we have on the court in Madrid on the Manolo Santana court really is inches away. And of course,
court
we're
level, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And who knows when, you know, at the time, Alcaraz Djokovic and Alcaraz Nadal felt special. And it's been a bit of a running joke all year, hasn't it? That, you know, when will they be united? But I am starting to think that it's a, you know, US Open Nadal Federer type situation.
Oh,
with
the
I don't know, the fates of the tennis gods are laughing at us somehow. But anyway, it does, you know, it does, the concoction of the conditions, the sort of relative, I guess players have had a bit of chance to bed in a bit on clay. I don't know what exactly it is, but do you tend to get good tennis matches here? And I feel like we've had above average numbers of thrillers so far this tournament. Would that be fair to say? I feel like I've been quite consistently thrilled over the last few days.
Could that be
anybody
because,
else?
Is that maybe because in some regard more of them are able to be up in lights because the tournament lasts longer and they're not, there's not as many simultaneously played tennis matches and therefore there's more on the show courts?
No, I'm talking about the quality of the tennis, not my ability to watch them. Well, not necessarily even the quality, the drama of the tennis. We've had a lot of deciding set tiebreaks, I think. I feel like that's been, you know, above quota. I don't know. Help me out, Matt. You were nodding. You were nodding when I was saying it, and now you've deserted me.
I'm racking my brain trying to think of all the thrillers that I've watched this week. I watched one last night. That was Holger Rune versus Alejandro Davidovich Fokina.
Well, Rune played back-to-back thrillers because he had a deciding set tiebreak against Bublik in the previous round.
Yes.
So that's a good number of thrillers.
The evidence is there. I can't think of any others.
There definitely has been one other. But anyway, look, the tennis has been good. Let's talk about some of it. Let's start with the women's draw, shall we? We've got all the last 16 matches being played or having been played today. Iga Świątek hasn't played yet today. Świątek hasn't played today. She's the last match of the day against Ekaterina Alexandrova. She will face Petra Martic in the quarterfinals because Petra Martic has just beaten Barbora Krejcikova in two straight sets. And Krejcikova's got a horrible record in Madrid. She got her first ever win here in her opening match this week. So obviously doesn't suit her particularly well. So it'll be Świątek or Alexandrova against Martic. It's been a pretty good week so far for old world number one clay court queen Iga Świątek, hasn't it?
Yeah, it certainly has. She's won her matches pretty straightforwardly. And I think perhaps most crucially for her is that Elena Rybakina went out of her half of the draw. A very surprising, to me anyway, loss to Anna Kalinskaya earlier in the week. And we've seen how Rybakina has had Świątek's number this year. And I was actually sort of hoping that match would happen on clay because I just wanted to see whether that Rybakina dominance over Świątek would translate to a clay court, especially in these quick conditions in Madrid. It felt like if anywhere was going to suit Rybakina for facing Świątek on clay, it probably would be Madrid. But Kalinskaya is one of those players who can pop up and occasionally have a good win, but rarely builds on it. And that's certainly what happened this week. Iga Świątek so far had a really good week, I think. And obviously this will be out of date by the time most people are listening to this. But Alexandrova, I think, does play well in Madrid. I think she reached the semis last year. So that's probably her first big test of the week, I would say, for Iga Świątek.
Saying players that pop up, have a big win, and then don't follow through with it, those are very triggering words for David just now.
Yeah, because they keep beating my players that have predicted will do stuff and get to the semi-finals or beyond and then doing nothing in the very next match. So what is the point of knocking out Yelena Ostapenko, Ludmila Samsonova? What is the point?
Thank you. Maxime Cressy knocking out Felix Auger-Aliassime at Wimbledon and then losing to...
Jack Sock.
I mean, really, Maxime.
It's very that, isn't it? I didn't have Świątek in my semi-final lineup. We've done semi-final predictions this time around just to make things interesting, because otherwise, you know, everyone's just going to go for Alcaraz and well, I say Świątek, but as I was just saying, I didn't have her in my semi-finals because of Rybakina. Because of Rybakina standing in her path to that semi-final. And I think in Rome, I would pick Świątek to come through that. But in Madrid, I thought about it and I thought the head-to-head plus the conditions, I would give Rybakina the edge. So I think that's a real break for Iga Świątek. She probably doesn't see it that way. She's world number one. She probably shouldn't be thinking in terms of, you know, lucky breaks, but that's how I see it. I have been implored, or we as a podcast have been implored this week to explain a little bit about altitude, because everybody mentions it in regards to Madrid, don't they? And there are other tournaments that are played at altitude. I mean, Quito. But Madrid is the most notable one, isn't it? The most prominent one that is played at altitude high enough that it affects conditions. And it doesn't sound like much, does it? It's 657 metres, the altitude of Madrid, which is the second highest capital city in Europe. If anybody can name the highest above sea level, then, well, there's no prize. But can anyone?
I think I thought it was Madrid, so no.
It's Andorra, the capital of Andorra, or whatever the capital of Andorra is, it's that. Anyway, we digress. 657 metres doesn't sound like much, but it is enough to significantly affect the flight of the tennis ball, because now I'm not going to divert too far into the realm of physics, because absolutely nobody wants that, not least me. But the air is less dense the higher up you go. Physically, fewer air particles, which means less resistance, less things for a ball to knock into as it travels through the air, which means it travels through the air more quickly. And players string their rackets differently at high altitude. Generally speaking, they'll string more for control than power. And, you know, it favours big servers for obvious reasons. A lot more than other clay court surfaces would. So that is my little GCSE bite-sized physics segment.
And if you look at some of the results over the years, Aryna Sabalenka's winning of it very comfortably a few years ago, thrashing Ash Barty in the final and loving the conditions when previously she hadn't really been into clay that much. Roger Federer did all right in Madrid, didn't he? I think he win the blue clay version of it? I seem to recall.
He did a tennis where he lived on that, David.
Yes, of course. and Nadal, I mean, look, obviously he won it 100 times, but he didn't win it 1,000 times, which obviously he has everything else. So, you know, everything's relative.
And of course, the other thing is that there's less oxygen in the air. The higher up you get, think about how aircraft cabins have to be pressurized. I mean, it is more of a physical challenge, I'm imagining. He's on court at the moment, isn't he? And actually, I don't think he has a fantastic record here, but Cameron Norrie's horse lungs, you'd imagine, probably come in rather handy here and everywhere.
But particularly
also, also on court at the moment, Jessica Pegula and Martina Trevisan. One of those will face Veronika Kudermetova in the quarterfinals. She's just sort of always there, isn't she? Kudermetova, plugging away.
That
never
was a
being
thriller
talked about
today.
There we go. Thank you very much, Matt. Where was that earlier?
I've just remembered it, and I don't know why, because I spent hours watching that today, and it was great.
Who was it against?
She beat Daria Kasatkina, saved a couple of match points down the stretch, and then she was a mini breakdown in the final set tiebreak, Kudermetova, and just suddenly it all clicked and she started firing winners. And yeah, she's very reliable, isn't she, Kudermetova, to consistently do well at these events. And I think, there are a lot of tests still ahead for Iga Świątek, even without Elena Rybakina, I would say, in that top half.
In the bottom half, the first quarterfinal will be Maria Sakkari against Arina Kamelia-Begu. I saw quite a lot of Sakkari beating Paula Badosa in two straight sets today. There were really good signs for Badosa, and there have been in the last few weeks. Charleston seemed like a really significant week from her. I mean, generally, just getting back on clay, it's been an uptick on a pretty low baseline over the course of the last 12 months for Badosa. But there's still something missing, the explosiveness, the spark. I'm sorry, I can't be more scientific than that about it, despite having set myself up as the science gal in this episode. But I can't quite put my finger on it. But even with this uptick in form, and things are looking a bit better, you know, she beat Coco Gauff 6-3, 6-love, and a lot of the tale of that match was Coco Gauff, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But look, there are green shoots of growth for Badosa. I just don't have any confidence at all that she's on her way back to where she was necessarily. There is something missing, and if I'm finding it frustrating, then goodness knows how she must feel. She looks fit. She looks hungry. When it's on, it looks every bit as good as it did. But the forehand is shaky under pressure. But it's the same. It's the same shot. You know, there doesn't look anything wrong. And as opposed to Coco Gauff, who we'll talk about, who, you know, was hitting whole games worth of forehand errors, you can see that there's something technically wrong there. I can't see anything wrong with what Badosa's doing, other than that it's not going in a lot of the time. And you have this feeling in your gut that it's not quite right.
Which makes me think that it is a more mental thing and about confidence, really. You know, we've talked a lot about Dominic Thiem over the last year or so, since fixing his injury, at least on the surface, he appears to be fit again, but unable to play quite the tennis he used to play. Sometimes it looks similar, so why aren't the results the same? And Badosa, I think to our naked eye, as people maybe that don't might not spot the very intricacies of what might be different technically. But even if there isn't anything different, there may be nothing different except that conviction when hitting the ball. And you know, when it gets tense and tight, I think that is so vital, really. The best players, they don't blink, they don't think, they just do.
And I was impressed with Sakkari today on that front, because there I was on the WhatsApp group making the jokes about Maria Sakkari being a set and a break up, and saying she's right in the danger zone now. It's definitely going. I was saying, look, I've got no confidence in Badosa, but it's definitely going three because Sakkari's a set and a break up. Lol. easiest lol in a tennis WhatsApp group there. It was a very cheap thrill. And I was, she made me look silly, because she, can't believe I'm going to say this about Maria Sakkari, but she didn't blink.
It was convincing, wasn't it? She was serving really well, which I think helped her. I do think, as you said, I think I detected that Badosa wasn't quite right. That spark wasn't there. because she wasn't able to force Zachary to get tight and get nervous. And, you know, she was just missing too much, really, that I think Zachary felt quite comfortable. But yeah, it was really impressive from Zachary. And I think, you know, I don't think any of us had Zachary going deep in this tournament. I think we all saw that section and thought, oh, let's take a bit of a gamble on a player. And I think I certainly went with Paola Badosa, having seen how she'd played in Charleston and in Stuttgart, where she really pushed Aryna Sabalenka. I thought there were, as you said, some really good signs from her. And I thought, you know, being in Madrid might help. But Zachary sort of showed that, yes, we talk a lot about Zachary's problems in the latter stages of tournaments, but she is at least consistently getting to those latter stages, which Paola Badosa hasn't been doing. And I think Zachary's just sort of form and recent experience of that showed today. She looked readier, I suppose, in the biggest moments today.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to see for Zachary, because, you know, she's got her doubters, us included, herself included. We know what her inner monologue is saying to her, right? Which makes her such a compelling watch, but almost certainly is what's also holding her back. It's fascinating. So, yeah, I do really feel it for her when she's doing well. Just pedaling back for a moment to that pretty crushing defeat for Coco Gauff to Paola Badosa. Just confirm for me that I'm not exaggerating how disastrous that was for Gauff. I mean, literally whole game's worth of forehand errors. She completely fell apart, if we're being frank, in that match.
Yeah, it was horrible to watch, actually. And it started out with just the forehand, and then I think all the confidence bled out of her completely, and it started infecting the rest of her game. And there were uncharacteristic backhand errors as well, and the serve wasn't particularly good, and it was just really, really bad. And I think all this season I've been waiting for Gauff to get back on the clay, because that's the surface where she's got the most time on the ball to hit that forehand, and she isn't rushed, and it looked pretty good last year. And, you know, let's not forget, of course, she reached the French Open final. She was playing brilliant tennis on this surface last year, but actually, having seen her on clay, they've been the worst performances of the year, really. I watched her in Stuttgart as well, and it wasn't good. And Paola Badosa essentially said in her press conferences this week before playing Gauff, I'm not going to tell you what my tactic is. And then she was asked after playing Gauff, well, it looked like the tactic was just hit it to the forehand. Is that right? And she said, yeah. And not even have to hit it into the forehand with much pace. Just make sure the ball was on Gauff's forehand and it would either break down, or Badosa knew she wasn't in much trouble in the rally. And it's becoming, well, unsustainable, I think, for Gauff. Something needs to change with that forehand. We've talked so much about the difficulties of changing it, but players are targeting it and it's not getting any better. And I really feel for her now, because it, as I said, it looks like it's affecting her whole game. I think before we knew it was a problem, but she was able to cover it up. She's not really covering it up anymore, and it's really, really tough to watch.
Yeah, I really feel for her, and it does feel like she's stuck in a vicious circle with it, doesn't it? So, oof, going to be interesting to see. She's got this longer gap than she would have done before Rome. I mean, not long enough to fix a forehand, I'm not suggesting that, but long enough to do some thinking. I don't know. But of course, the last time we kind of checked in with her about it, or tried to check in with her about it, very understandably, her attitude seemed to be, I don't want to get in my head about it, so let's not go there on the forehand. I don't want to feed into this narrative. But it just feels so unavoidable now, as you say, Matt, that, oof, I don't know. French Open final points to defend. Yeah, a bit worried for her. But yeah, wish her well. In the final quarterfinal in the women's draw. Incredible story here. We got Aryna Sabalenka through to the quarterfinals, and it does, you know, as much as we've talked up the other people sort of lurking, it does look like we're on for a Sabalenka-Świątek rematch in the final. A lot can happen before then, but that, well, certainly the seedings say that's what we're on for. Sabalenka beat one of the two stories, I would say, of the women's tournament to get to the quarterfinal. She beat Mira Andreev, who you might not have heard of because she is a now 16-year-old, but at the time of her wins this week was a 15-year-old. She beat Leila Fernandez and Beatriz Haddad-Meyer and Magda Linette all in straight sets before losing 6-3, 6-1 to Aryna Sabalenka. She is fun and exciting, I think, Mira Andreeva. Last week we referenced a meeting we'd had with a journalist from the Financial Times to talk about a Wimbledon preview piece. And he asked us to tip some youngsters for long-range future success. And I really want to go back in time and have mentioned Mira Andreeva at that meeting. But in all honesty, like, I'd heard of her. She was one of those names that was kicking around from juniors, etc. But she was not really on my radar as somebody even close to capable of doing this. And, you know, we're in that, we have to walk that fine line with this. Nothing's a given. We don't want to predict too much for them too soon. You know, your body's still growing at that age. So much can change. But she's also fantastically exciting and has a lot of chutzpah, David. I like to see.
Well, I really took notice, I think, during the first set of the match against Beatriz Haddad-Meyer, when I noticed a tweet, I think from the WTA Insider account, quoting Andreeva talking about how she likes to think of herself in terms of Ons Jabeur's game. And you know, imagine that. I'm suddenly thinking, crikey, I want to go and watch this woman immediately. And I was in a position where I couldn't go and watch all the match. So I immediately said, Matt, are you available? Go and watch her. Is she anything like Ons Jabeur? And I mean, Matt, I think you drew attention to there was a bit of difference about her. It wasn't all the same. I mean, she was referencing in this quote her topspin, which, I don't know, I don't necessarily think of Jabeur as a topspin-heavy player, although the forehand has got some on it, I guess. But the sheer fact that she's thinking in those terms, anybody who thinks of themselves in the same sentence as Ons Jabeur is somebody I want to follow and want to watch. And then you see the names she's racked up in succession. And here I am talking about players who get a win, you take notice of them, and then they struggle to back it up because it's not easy to do. I mean, to be 15 and then turn in 16 in the middle of a Masters 1000 event and, you know, knocked out today in this what is now the second week of this tournament, that is a heck of a run. And you know, who knows what this transfers into in the future, but that's a fantastic platform.
Yeah, and it's been a run that has been sort of in the making on the ITF circuit, because she reached the junior final of the Australian Open this year, and it was a heartbreaking loss. I remember keeping an eye on the scoreline there. I think it was on a really stiflingly hot day in Melbourne, the junior final this year, and it was just this epic, and she lost it late in the third set, but since then, as tough as that defeat was, she's really bounced back and has put together this incredible streak, you know, in her first pro matches on the ITF tour. And she came into Madrid having won 13 matches in a row, and I was listening today to Naomi Brody in commentary, and she was saying one of the things she finds most impressive is exactly what you were saying, David, in terms of backing wins up. You know, she's played so much tennis in the last month. Something, you know, basically she's played a match pretty much every day, really, or certainly been playing so many matches over the last month. But physically, she still looked really strong, and her conditioning is is clearly very, very good. In terms of her game, I think I saw her at the back end of that match against Hadad Maia, and she was really digging in and having to fight. And I don't think she was sort of expressing herself fully, but it was really impressive how she was handling the pace. And she's got a nice slice forehand, which I suppose is a little bit Ons Jabeur-like. She can use that to sort of mix up the spins and the variety. She's got an older sister whose game she compared to Iga Świątek. So,
they're big on themselves. I love it.
They're very big on themselves. they were playing doubles together this week. So, you know, I think her sister's a little bit older. So, you know, certainly one to watch as well. And then today against Sabalenka, she started off really, really well. It was a very competitive first six games, and she was giving Sabalenka, you know, a lot to handle, and she was dealing with Sabalenka's pace, but eventually Sabalenka just sort of overwhelmed her. I was sort of reminded of a football match I watched earlier in the week or highlights of. You know how in under 21 football, sometimes a senior player is allowed to drop down into it if they want match minutes. And I watched Fulham Brentford this week, and Christopher Ajer was playing for Brentford. He is a 2 meter tall centre back, and he was just crunching into tackles against these under 21 Fulham players who didn't really stand a chance. And the latter stages of Sabalenka Andreeva today reminded me of that. As good as Andreeva already is and a talent, she's coming up against a fully developed sort of just someone who is capable of overpowering her. And that is eventually what happened in this match. But a really thrilling week for Andreeva. There's all sorts of stats about how she's the third youngest player, I think, to win a main draw match at a WTA 1000 event since they sort of rebranded them. And it's been exciting to see her win and back it up. And she gave a brilliant interview as well, where she talked about what the best thing was about being in these events. And she said it was seeing Andy Murray and how beautiful he is in real life. she's got real personality to match the game. So it's been really exciting.
Yeah, she's great. Remember the name. Look out for her. We're going to try and walk the tightrope of being excited whilst not piling too much pressure on. I mentioned that she's one of two standout stories in the women's side of things this week. And I think the other one is Maya Sharif, the Egyptian player. She's into the quarters. She will play Aryna Sabalenka there. And talking of, you know, backing up big wins, she beaten Camilla Giorgi. That was via retirement in the opening round, but then backed that up with wins over Angelina Kalinina, who I saw play a lot in Madrid last year. She was a quarterfinalist here last year, and she really can play, and particularly in these conditions. She is a tricky customer to get past. She beat Eliza Mertens, and she's beaten Caroline Garcia, Maya Sharif. I mean, I know she's in and out, Garcia, but my goodness me, that is a run. And she's a cracking story, isn't she? She's 26 years old, but she went through the university route. She went to Pepperdine University in California, got her degree. So, you know, transferred to play pro tennis into her 20s. You know, in terms of her canister, she's younger than her years, if you like. Thinks of Madrid as her second home. I think left Egypt at age 15 and spent 2 years training in Madrid. She's been doing her on-court post-match interviews in Spanish, and the crowd have been absolutely loving her. She first, well, certainly came to my attention. I think this is a shared experience for all of us, when she almost beat Carolina Pliskova, I think it was, in the first round of Roland Garros, to quote John McEnroe, out of nowhere. a few years ago, and it's been up and down for her since then. Every now and then she pops up, doesn't she, and reminds us how exciting she is. But this feels like, you know, the most standout week she's had, and I'm so pleased for her, because she is charming as hell and a great story and a real a real tennis player.
Yeah, I think she was a little bit disappointed with her form so far this year. I think she told Reem Abalil, but has come to Madrid and has really rediscovered her best stuff. And I love her intensity. I know you're working on an intensity list, Catherine.
She is eyes emoji under review.
Yeah.
I like it too.
Yeah, and big game, big forehand, and yeah, it's going to be exciting to see her bring that. I think against Sabalenka, and she's also just sort of one of those players who you would not want to draw. I think at the French Open, if you're a top player, because she's going to be a real handful, I think, especially on this surface. And if she can keep going and keep getting her ranking up, I think there'll be a lot of players who actually would be quite pleased about that.
Am I right that two of these women's quarterfinals are being played tomorrow, Tuesday, and two of them will be played Wednesday? They're being split over the 2 days. I think tomorrow we get Sabalenka, Sharif, and Sakari Begu. And then the other two must be on Wednesday. Really looking forward to the time when all draws and all sides of all draws are at the same stage on the same day. I fear that time might never come, or at least I'll have to wait for the weekend. But hoping and praying.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
On to the men's draw, where we've got to the bottom half round three matches today. So completely different stage of proceedings to the women. Well done, tennis. So what have we had set up? We have round four matches that are to be thus. Carlos Alcaraz against Alexander Zverev, two former champions, of course. Karen Khachanov against Andrei Rublev. These matches are tomorrow. Khachanov Rublev is first on Manolo Santana, and Alcaraz Zverev is third. We've got Jaume Munar against Daniel Altmaier. That'll open things up on the Arantxa Sanchez Stadium tomorrow. In fact, I think all of these matches might be tomorrow. Let's say that that's the case.
There was a little bit of aggro, by the way, between Munar and Kokkinakis that I saw. Did you see that?
We're coming back to that, David. Let me finish my list.
Okay.
And we'll come back to memorable moments from the week so far. Čorić versus Alejandro Davidovich Fokina. Jana Nedstrup against Pedro Cachin. Bernabe Zapata Miralles against either Stefanos Tsitsipas or Sebastian Baez. And they are in a third set. Baez's love one, 30 all. We'll keep you posted on that. Taylor Fritz will take on either Zhang or Cameron Norrie. It's looking like it's going to be Cameron Norrie. He and his horse lungs are a set to the good at the moment. And then we have Daniil Medvedev against...
happening again, Aslan Karatsev.
Aslan Karatsev. He's back. So that is what we've got set up in the men's. Only Tsitsipas or Baez left to book their spots in the last 16. Let's talk about some of the thrilling tennis that we've seen so far this week to set up those round of 16 matches. Back to you, David, for the aggro update.
Sorry, Carlos Alcaraz and Holger Rune and everybody else. You've got to stand in line because I caught a few seconds of Jaume Munar going up to the net upon winning match point against Thanasi Kokkinakis and saying, "Don't you tell me to shut up again." And Kokkinakis saying, "Or what?" And Munar clearly didn't quite know what "or what" meant because he just kept repeating what he'd said, to which Kokkinakis kept repeating "or what," and then and then Munar eventually tried to explain why he'd told or why he was annoyed at him, and on it went, and eventually they went their separate ways, and so I don't think there ever was an "or what" incident. Conclusion, but anyway, it was briefly entertaining, and Munar appears to be still in the draw, so he's doing quite well.
It will annoy me if Tsitsipas crushes Dominic Thiem's dreams and then loses to Sebastian Baez. That will annoy me. Sorry, Sebastian Baez, nothing personal at all, but I feel like I gave so much emotionally to Dominic Thiem the other night and his thriller. There we go. There's another thriller. That was the definition of thriller.
Was it significant for Dominic Thiem the fact that he pushed Stefanos Tsitsipas to a final set tiebreak, or is the fact that Tsitsipas is only beating Thiem 7-6 in the third and now struggling against Baez more a reflection of Tsitsipas not being really close to his best at the moment?
I don't think Tsitsipas is close to his best. I don't. I think he's struggling. I think he's reaching for form. But let's face it, Dominic Thiem has been so far away that even a not quite in form Stefanos Tsitsipas has been so out of reach to think that he could play a match like that against Tsitsipas. I think I'd stopped hoping for Dominic Thiem because it was crushing me. And I didn't, you know, him splitting with Nicolas Massu, I didn't like the sound of that. I'd heard rumblings about him contemplating retirement. You know, I'd been hearing nothing but dark things from the Dominic Thiem camp. And what I hope, I refuse to believe, assuming he's fit, and I think he is, you know, he's had a good run without any injury concerns or niggles. I know with the wrist, there's a big psychological element to that type of injury, getting rid of that brain worm that makes you feel like something's going to go wrong every time you hit your forehand. I'm aware of that, but assuming he's fit, I refuse to believe that he isn't capable of playing great tennis again. He is too good for that not to be in there somewhere. And I feel like what he needs is proof of concept, proof that it's possible, just some sort of boost to give him the belief that he can get back there. He must be so bereft just now about why it's not happening, why you can't find it. And I know this might be irrational. Maybe you two are able to be more rational and you can tell me how irrational I am being. But I just hope this match was that. I just hope it was enough evidence that it's possible, that it's within touching difference if he just keeps believing to spur him on. And maybe... didn't matter if he win or lost for that reason. The point was the tennis he was able to produce. It felt a bit inevitable to me that when it went down to a deciding set tiebreak, I mean, of course he's not going to have the muscle memory and the match tightness to be able to come through something like that. It really would have surprised me if he'd found a way there in the end. But I hope this is the turning point so desperately. But I realise that might be, I don't know, that might be heart overhead.
I mean, it doesn't look like he is physically impeded anymore to me. Maybe, I know Andy Murray talked about how his forehand is inhibited, but is that a mental thing or is that a physical thing? I suppose that's a question mark. And he can't dominate necessarily with that shot the way he used to be able to. But he doesn't look like he's taking loads off the ball or anything like that. It just feels like confidence and belief and groove, really, being out there on a big court playing players that he used to beat and beating them. I do feel as though that my bigger concern is when he plays people that are way short of where he used to be and who he used to just mop up the way top players do, and he's having real faff with them. Him playing Tsitsipas hard is encouragement, but to give me belief that he's actually taken it any further, he needs to start beating people comprehensively and efficiently.
Yeah, I think team's answer to that question is the answer. Like, if team is able to take belief and confidence from coming so close against a top player like Tsitsipas, then great, he can build on that. But if team thinks, oh, it's yet another close, narrow defeat, I think it's his third deciding set tiebreak that he's lost this year. And if he thinks, oh, again, and it's like, deflating
someone
for him.
Someone get that man in a lift with David Law.
Right, for real. David will say his words of wisdom,
just keep at it.
Keep at it.
It'll come.
I would give him such a hype talk, honestly.
Oh, that's what he needs.
I bloody love
Dominic Honestly,
Team.
I'd love you to put an arm around Dominic T and hype him up. David hypes people like no other. Mm. Oh, that's what he needs. There's an opening now, David. Masu not on the seam. Although his fitness guy looks pretty hype-tastic to me.
I was going to say, I don't think I could beat him somehow.
He's got a lot. I'm not sure how your energy would mesh with his. Might just be too much.
I just end up saying, just calm down a bit, mate, all right?
I've got the hype, dude. You back in your box.
Time and a place.
Does that guy send the perfect voice note at, you know, early in the morning so you wake up to it as David does? I don't know, but I don't think so.
Not many people do, in my experience. Right, let's talk Holger Rune, shall we? He's given us a lot this week. He's out of the tournament. But with a bang, rather, as I said, he came through in his opening match, I think it was. Yeah, his opening match against Alexander Bublik, 7-6 in the third. Thriller. Can confirm that was a thriller. There was the most extraordinary match point save from Alexander Bublik with a little pickup volley from his feet, which he celebrated with both sort of a combination of Alcaraz and Medvedev energy. Just looked at the crowd like, you are going to give that the respect it deserves, guys. And they did. They absolutely loved it. The whole vibe was incredible. And then Holger Rune finds himself in another hashtag thriller late last night with Alejandro Davidovich Fokina. This one had a little bit of everything, including Carlos Bernardes parenting Holger Rune. I feel like they're assigning, he's like his, chaperone on tour. They're assigning Carlos Bernardes to his matches. Even Carlos yesterday even back referenced their match in Madrid, in Monte Carlo. He said, Holger, I told you in Monte Carlo, this won't get you anywhere. It's just wasted energy, son.
Shouldn't be doing
that. I've editorialised a bit there, but you get the idea.
You know, we criticise Mohamed Lahoun for doing it.
Do you mean the tone?
Well, no, more just he's taken a part in the match right there, isn't he? I mean, remember what happened to Mohamed Lahoun? He got suspended for doing that with Nick Kyrgios, or at least trying to get him to improve his attitude back in the US Open.
I think it's walking a line, for sure. I mean, I find it funny, but yeah, I agree. It occurred to me. I think it's probably just the right side of the line for me. But
Paul
I agree,
Garuna
it's a judgment call.
I mean, you know, imagine the blooming thought process to sort of go and look as though you're about to rub out a mark that Alejandro Davidovic Fokina is kicking off about in front of a Spanish crowd.
Although the marks are irrelevant now.
I know, but still,
they
come
use video
on.
Review, which
love it.
That I am generally in favour of video review, and with caveats, rolling out electronic line calling, which the ATP this week have announced that they're going to be doing at all tour events from 2025, except on clay. I do find it completely bonkers that we're using a system with a margin for error when there is a physical mark available that just isn't being looked at. That's silly to me. He got booed off court yesterday, Holger Rune. What do we think of that? Booed off court and then to cap off a bad evening after losing, of course, to Davidovic Fokina, who we will talk about. I saw on Twitter, and it had an hour on the tarmac in my Iberia flight earlier, and I used that time to do a number of things. And one of them was discover that Holger Rune blocked the Holger Rune News Twitter account last night.
For doing what? Do we know?
Don't know. It was only positive Holger Rune News tweets in there. He was trying to be his hype man, you know. I assume it's a he, I don't know. Tough one for Holger Rune last night. Tough one to stomach.
And I've just seen on Twitter that he has put out a statement about last night, saying there was a lot of talk today about bad behaviour among Spanish fans last night. I mean, I would pause there and say I think maybe there was more talk about bad behaviour from you, Holger. But anyway.
But the Spanish fans haven't put out a statement. So anyway.
He continues, yesterday the crowd didn't understand what was going on. You cannot overrule a computer call, and it took the umpire and supervisor a very long time to explain this to my opponent, and they didn't bother to communicate this to the crowd. Next time I will take a nap while they discuss. Just want to say that personally, I hold nothing against the Spanish people, and I look forward to coming back to the mature Madrid Open.
Good. He's a big man for not holding that against the whole of the Spanish people. it takes a big man to be able to do that.
And in breaking news, someone has replied saying in capitals, unblock Holger Rune News, and Holger has replied, it's not blocked.
Well, hang on a second. A number of questions here. Do we think Holger composed that himself, or is his mum still in charge of his social media?
I mean, it's quite chaotic, yeah. Social media, isn't it?
It is quite chaotic. Which, I mean, that could be his mum, it could be him. Who knows?
Holger, keep doing it. We're loving it. I'm loving it.
We are loving it. I loved that match last night. I mean, Alejandro Davidovic Fokina is a banker for a fun time, isn't he? And we were tweeting during it. We were WhatsApping during it, and you know, we were sort of lamenting he's such a fun time, but during that fun time you're not backing him to win. You've got this slightly hollow feeling in your stomach, knowing that he'll probably deliver the fun time right up until a moment before the end and then fail to deliver. I think this was massive for him that he got across that line. Massive.
Yeah, I completely agree. I loved this match. And one thing I really liked about it was that David Ferrer was sitting in about row two in the stadium. And you kept getting these shots of you know, Alejandro Davidovich Fokina ready to return serve, and sort of just behind him, David Ferrer. And I was thinking, you know, it feels a little bit like he needs a bit more Ferrer in him. He needs to be just that little bit more reliable. But at the same time, if he were, I think that would take away the fun element. And that is the word that most often comes to mind when I think of Davidovich Fokina. He is such a fun watch. And maybe different to Ferrer in that he is also capable of having these incredible injections and suddenly looking like, you know, he's capable of sort of beating anyone. And I think he really displayed that in the final moments of this match, because he should have won it in two sets. He felt a breakdown at the start of the third, and then he did brilliantly to get that break back. I thought he was gone. And he then serves for the match, and I thought, wow, okay, we're in a great place. He then lost 9 of the next 10 points, and he was choking. He was coming up with these terribly timed drop shots. You know how we always talk about Alcaraz getting the drop shot right? Davidovich Fokina was just getting it horribly wrong. Every time he hit it, he just winced because it was clearly the wrong shot choice.
And his coach was doing full David Law at this stage, wasn't he? Like, sort of, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Positivo, positivo.
But he was love 30 down then, Davidovich Fokina, and suddenly came up with 4 incredible forehand winners, sort of each one bigger than the next, and ended up taking over and winning. And I think that's really big for him. You know, Mary Carrillo always says he choked and he won anyway. And I think that's quite impressive to sort of overcome himself there and come through the other side and be hitting freely again. And he's in a section of the draw now which is wide open. He's in that Chorich, Munar, Altmaier section. And you know, if he recovers physically from this match, it was long, and I can go on a mini rant about how they've made Madrid 12 days, and yet they still insist on tennis happening at 1 o'clock in the morning, which is just,
well, there was a moment when Carlos Bernardes spoke to the crowd and said, "For goodness sake, everyone, that it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Please, yeah. please respect the players," or something. And it was this real sort of breaking the fourth wall moment. Like, we all know this is stupid, but it's, you know, we're not supposed to say it, not while it's actually happening.
I mean,
anyway,
look, it's only a minor example, but I was absolutely hanging on this match. I loved everything about it, from the two personalities involved, the tennis, the atmosphere, the drama, the aggro, everything. And yet I went to sleep at halfway through the second set because I couldn't stay up anymore. And really that's partly because I'm getting old and all the rest of it. But how many people were in the crowd? I'm curious to know. Right at the end, was it full?
It was a good crowd, but one of the things in Madrid, of course, I mean, a day in Madrid is pushed back to a day that we know it. You know, things do go on later. I don't think 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. are prime viewing hours for sport. You know, La Liga doesn't schedule matches at that time. I still don't think it's right that tennis is being played at that time. But in Madrid, I think you are going to get fans staying later. But the setup in the stadium there, of course, is that the lower levels are these sort of boxes, and they're the more expensive seats, and the VIP seats, they weren't that full. But then the upper sections with, you know, your ordinary fans was pretty packed, and there was a really good atmosphere. So it didn't suffer. It didn't feel like it was being played in front of nobody. But equally, it could have been played in front of more people, and you know, the players have got to recover from that. It wasn't ridiculously late, but everything, you know, it's fine margins, isn't it? And having that really late finish could end up impacting Davidovich Fokina. And I just don't understand how they've extended Madrid so much. You know, they've added an extra 5 days to the tournament. They used to get this event done in a week. There's so much time. Okay, I know there's a few more players in the draw now, but there's so much time. There really doesn't feel like there should be any need to be playing tennis at 1 o'clock in the morning. I don't understand why tennis keeps doing it.
A couple of other results, matches, men to touch upon quickly because we are running out of time. Daniil Medvedev won today, was referred to in various quarters this match as a piece of performance art by Daniil Medvedev. A potted review, Matt?
Well, I joined this match in the third set and loved it. I mean, it was just sort of classic Medvedev. He was sticking a load of tissue up his nose. He was pouring a lot of water into his eye. He started bowing at one point after hitting winners, which was a sort of reference back to the fact that the crowd had sort of been booing him at the end of the first set. It was all the Medvedev hits. He was up against Shevchenko, who is a player I don't know much about at all, and he was really in trouble. Breakdown in that final set, but managed to come through it. Shevchenko was struggling physically by the end, clearly cramping, and Medvedev, I think, was able to hide his cramps because he didn't even sort of get up to sign the camera at the end of the match. He wanted the camera brought to him to sign it. I think he was struggling physically as well. It was really hot in the sort of middle of the day in Madrid. But yeah, Medvedev on clay basically continues to enthrall and entertain, and long may it last.
Yeah, the hits keep coming. And last but by no means least, Carlos Alcaraz, as we said, he set up a fourth round match against another former champion, Alexander Zverev, in the fourth round. We've seen two matches from him so far. Rocky start for Alcaraz. Better yesterday against Grigor Dimitrov. A lot better, actually, I would say. First round needed three thrilling sets, I would say, to come through against, or certainly thrilling periods throughout the match, to come through against Emil Ruiz-Vori, a player that I've never quite understood. I know he's still young, there's still plenty of time, but I've never quite understood why he doesn't have better results. He, other than a bit of variety, he looks a really complete tennis player to me, very much in the sort of Jannik Sinner, Andrei Rublev mold of incredibly fast twitch arms and, you know, those drilled ground strokes. I've got a question mark over the Fang situation for Emil Ruiz-Vori. Put out a tweet after the match, which, I don't know, he's not getting him anywhere near my intensity / chutzpah list. I know, look, people have different feelings about this. It was a lovely tweet. He just said, you know, what a pleasure it was to be part of the match with Carlos Alcaraz. Lovely. I don't like that. I want them to be, I don't know, he lost a match from a winning position. I want him to be furious and not see it as a pleasure. I want him to have more, you know, heartbreak energy. I don't know, it makes me question his fangs, but I'm being harsh. I'm a big fan of his tennis. And Alcaraz for a set and a half there was bad. By his own standards, I thought he was really bad. And he, you know, Ruiz-Vori had definitely, you know, exactly as I said there, we're like, my game's a little bit like Jannik Sinner's. Jannik Sinner's got quite a good record against Carlos Alcaraz. Maybe I'll watch some of their previous matches. Smart move. And without question, that would have been a factor. But Alcaraz still, I think, was reaching big time in those opening stages.
Yeah, he was loose, wasn't he, Alcaraz? He was missing all over the place, and Ruiz-Vori's good. I mean, he is a really talented guy who's got a compact game, and yeah, he was in a great position. And then next thing I know, Matt, I kind of hand over to you to watch the third set. It's over in about 10 minutes.
Yeah, it was pretty exhilarating, actually, how Alcaraz just found his game, just ignited, and that third set was much more your typical Alcaraz match, winning points that you feel like Ruiz-Vori's already won, and yet somehow Alcaraz manages to get his foot to the ball and hit an incredible winner or something. And yeah, I think Alcaraz said afterwards that he was a little bit overwhelmed, I guess, being in Madrid. There's an awful lot of attention on him. Nadal is not there. He is the guy. at the biggest tournament in Spain, and he wouldn't have had that before. I think maybe slightly explained that slow start, but generally it felt like we've maybe already reached the stage with Alcaraz where he can play not very well, and he can play an opponent who's playing really well, and yet he can still win. And that's sort of the edge that all the best players have, I think, over the rest of the field. And that feels like a step that Alcaraz has made this year, even compared to last year. You know, he isn't going out early in tournaments at all, really. He's, even if he's taking time to find his feet, he's still able to win matches, maybe a little bit even with his aura. You know, it felt like Ruusuvuori got tight. He suddenly thought, wow, I might beat Alcaraz in Madrid. It was a big moment for him. And if Alcaraz has kind of got that in his locker already as well, then yeah, you just sort of fear for the rest of the field, really.
Yeah, absolutely. He remains the favourite at this stage, but a lot of tennis to be played. Tsitsipas currently serving for the match against Sebastian Baez, 5-3 in the third set. Breakback point, Baez, so yeah, write your own ending to that one. We do have a few bits of news, talking points from the last week that we wanted to have time to get onto, but spent too much time talking about all of just too many thrillers to cover. There's been a bit of a story this week regarding Emma Raducanu, certainly in the British press, which I don't think we have time. I want to be able to cover it properly, so perhaps we'll carve out a bit of time to talk about that on Thursday. Needless to say, it wasn't a great week for her. She came to Madrid, ended up withdrawing ahead of her scheduled first round match with a wrist injury, but not before having a very terse exchange with a couple of the British print journalists that had gone out there to speak to her and the other Brits. And it was very widely reported here in the UK. We're not brushing past it. We just want to be able to cover it properly. So we'll perhaps park that one until Thursday. There was a Jeannie Bouchard tweet that garnered quite a lot of attention this week. She beat Diana Yastremska in the opening round. A reminder that Bouchard had also, a few years ago, beat Maria Sharapova in Madrid shortly after Maria Sharapova was coming back from her ban. And she put out a tweet, did Jeannie Bouchard, something pretty incendiary, which could have been in relation to Yastremska's failing an anti-doping test, which was subsequently overturned when a tribunal, quote, accepted her account of how Mesterolone entered her system and determined that she bore no fault or negligence for the violation. And then she subsequently tweeted an apology. I want to apologise for my tweet yesterday. It was a lapse in judgment and unnecessary. Though I've always championed fair play, I didn't have all my facts in order and certainly didn't mean to cause harm. I'm going to continue to work on myself going forward, both on and off the court. Everyone's saying that they're going to work on themselves in tweets, aren't they? Let's all go and work on ourselves. Also, an update this week from Simona Halep, who we haven't heard much from recently because she's been serving a provisional ban for testing positive for roxadustat at the US Open last August. She denies knowingly taking the banned substance. She's been provisionally suspended for the last 6 months. She released a video on the Tennis Majors website and social media feeds this week. That's the site, the brand that is owned by Patrick Mouratoglou. Of course, her sort of former current sort of coach on hiatus, I think, maybe. He's certainly very present in Holger Rune's team and box at the moment. Who knows whose payroll he's on, but anyway, she says in the interview, in the video, I'm not asking for special treatment. I just ask to be judged. How much longer is this going to take? At this age, it's really tough to lose days, weeks and months. You're scared about the injuries. When you don't have the official matches, it's more risky. When time passes like this, it's harder to come back. The International Tennis Integrity Unit, responsible for testing in the sport, said the process is ongoing. It added that the former world number one Halep's case was, quote, being run in line with the world anti-doping code. Halep mentioned the ITF in her video, and they clarified, the ITF has no involvement in the management of this case, as the tennis anti-doping program is managed and enforced by the International Tennis Integrity Agency, the ITIA, on behalf of the ATP, WTA, ITF, and Grand Slam. So that throws up a discussion about provisional bans, which again, you know, we probably don't have time to get into the whole debate here, but there certainly is a debate around provisional suspensions, whether they are correctly applied, whether if you're going to have a system of provisional suspensions, it is fair that the process of bringing it to a judgment takes so long. I mean, this must feel like an incredibly long process for Simona Halep, but equally, you know, you can imagine, say she tested positive August last year. I mean, imagine a situation where players are testing positive and just continuing to compete normally on tour. That would be problematic as well. I don't have the answers, but I certainly sympathise with Simona Halep's frustration, and it's something worth shedding light on, I think. And I think that's just about your lot, other than to footnote that Andy Murray is playing in a challenger this week in Aix-en-Provence, where he plays Gael Monfils in round one.
Gotta
love it. We are through the looking glass now, kids. Andy Murray and Gael Monfils that split the four junior Grand Slam titles in 2004. I mean, Andy Murray only got one. Gael Monfils won the other three. And here they are, ages, they might both must be 35, 36. Various assorted injuries. Gael Monfils has all his original body parts. But I'd say,
as far as we know,
but of late has been sort of in an even worse physical state than Andy Murray. And there they are playing in round one of I mean, I'm going to be finding the stream and watching it. I hope it doesn't make me sad. That's my only wish for that match. And Tommy Paul is the top seed. Well, get down to Aix-en-Provence, I would say. Also a lovely city. So that really is your lot for this week in tennis, except to tell you that our mascot for this episode is Kiwi. Kiwi is owned by Chloe and Haley. And before I read the blurb, I'm going to look at her and guess that she is a Chihuahua. That's my guess. She's adopting a very Billie Jean-esque sleeping pose on a very plush-looking rug throw type item in this picture. And she looks very peaceful and lovely and like a dog I would like to cuddle. Chloe and Haley say she adores lounging under blankets. Yep, great. Whenever she's not playing. And each evening at 10 p.m, she calmly plants her 10-pound Chihuahua frame in her crate, demands to have us close the crate door, and then further demands that we leave the room promptly so that she may rest for the night. Like the queen. Wow. What a spirit. That's what Chloe and Haley say. Wow. What a queen indeed. She sounds absolutely amazing. Be more Kiwi, I would say, is my advice to everybody out there in the world. We have our mascots. David has Maisie. Right, Maisie. I've got Xenia, and Matt has Darwin. We've all got some skin left in the Madrid predictions game this week. Some flailing skin. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. And we have shout outs, Matt.
We have Vicky Cole, who is near Salisbury in the UK.
Like Joe Salisbury.
Right, Vicky.
Yes. And Vicky says that she's lived in Kenya and Sri Lanka with very patchy TV coverage of even the big events. So the podcast has been great for keeping up with what's going on.
Oh,
and would you believe when we had Vicky Spreadbury the other week, and I couldn't think of a Vicky. We had an email from a Julian Mills who says, I think you missed a trick on tennis Vickys. What about Vicky Nelson of the extremely long tie break where 1 point consisted of a rally of over 600 shots?
600? That can't be right. What?
Honest. That's what the email says. I haven't verified
shots.
It.
That's giving me flashbacks of Karenia Buster against Nishikori.
Did Vicky throw her bag across the court at the end of the match?
Thank you, Vicky.
We've also got Alec Mills from Bristol.
Right, Alec.
Hello, Alec. My granddad was an Alec. He was an Alexander and an Alex, but also an Alec, and he was a truly lovely man. So great name. Oh. And we also have Sir Alec Ferguson of being aggressively doorstopped by David at the US Open 2012 fame. Of course,
yes,
that is, you know, not necessarily what he's most famous for, but around these parts it is.
Not in his Wikipedia, but we know about it.
Hello, Alec. Great name. Thank you for your support.
And finally, we have Dan Hatch, who is an Australian in London, but originally from Perth.
All right, Dan.
Hello, Dan. Perth of tennis players having their photos taken with Quokka's fame.
Oh, yeah.
We love those photos. And Dan of, I mean, we've got to go Dan Evans, haven't we? Dan of Dialer Dan fame.
Hey. Top
Any
man
other
Dan.
Tennis Dans? Dan. Is, Daniel Altmaier?
Is Daniel Altmaier? Yeah, is he a Dan?
Nestor?
Yeah. I think we peaked with Dan Evans. I'm sure Dan's like, that's fine. You've done me proud. Thank you very much, Dan. I hope you find that a satisfactory list of tennis Dans. Thank you to all of our friends of the Tennis Podcast for your continued support. If you don't already know, our Q&A show that we recorded all together last week is now available, including on YouTube, if you'd like to watch it. The link to watch it is in our newsletter and in the show notes. So if you'd like to listen or watch and you're not already a Friends subscriber, you can become one for £5 a month or £50 a year. You can also get a shout out or introduce a podcast. The link to do all of that is in our show notes. And for real this time, that really is your lot. But it is a 1,000 week, so we'll be back on Thursday. I'll have news from the ground, hopefully, and we will all be back with you. So we'll speak to you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.